So in 1972, Harry Shirky's frustration finally boiled over. The pediatrician and pharmacist felt little closer to his long-term goal of assuring that drugs used in the United States in children were both safe and effective. He asked a series of provocative questions in his speeches, publications, and Capitol Hill testimony, which he reprinted in his new text on children and pharmaceuticals, published in 1972. Next slide. Oh, I have no disclosure. Sorry. So what was it intended that infants and children be singled out for neglect when two major pieces of 20th century drug legislation, one in 1938 and one in 1962, were enacted? Did Congress, he wondered, intend only those who had passed puberty to benefit? He argued that it was long past time for those under the age of 18 years to languish as therapeutic orphans, a term he had coined a few years earlier, denied what he called their pharmacological rights through commonplace disclaimers on labels, acknowledging the lack of pediatric data. Whose job was it, he asked, to speak for children and fix this long-standing problem? This paper is part of a larger study on children and pharmaceuticals in the United States. In this chapter, I'm really just giving some overarching political, legislative, and regulatory history that ends. It begins in 1933. I had originally planned to start 1945. Like all good historians, I now have to go back, and it ends in 1979 when everyone thinks they've solved the problem. And this, I first learned about this as an issue in 2001. I was lucky enough to be doing a fellowship on Capitol Hill in the office of Paul Wellstone, and I was asked to staff a hearing for what became the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act and the Pediatric Research Equity Act. And next slide, please. I was shocked to hear Chris Dodd talk about that most of the drugs we were using in kids had never been tested for them, and I couldn't figure out where I'd been. I'd been a pediatric nurse for more than 20 years at that point. I had just finished a dissertation on a topic related to the history of children's health, and I had really had taught as a practicing nurse and a clinical instructor of pediatrics. I spent a lot of time inculcating into my students this complicated dance that pediatricians, pediatric nurses, and pharmacists participate in about calculating milligrams per kilo per dose per day for whatever, and I was always sure that we had that what we were doing made some kind of sense. And I felt like, A, apologizing to every student I'd ever taught, because I was a very officious type of nursing instructor, and as well as the children who I cared for. So, and it seemed to me that this was a great question to be answered with a historical study, because what little I knew was that most of the pieces of legislation, as Harry Shirky said, had been enacted because of disasters about kids. And why then hadn't things gotten any better? Why in 2001 and 2002 were we talking about this problem? And as I mentioned, Shirky had long been raising this question, even as early as the 1950s. Next slide, please. As he pointed out, the agency had been founded in 1906, partly in response to the longstanding use of what were called soothing syrups or opium-laced syrups that were marketed for well over 100 years prior to mothers for everything from teething to just get your child to sleep, resulted in the passing of the 1906 Act that led to the founding of the FDA. Although the flaws in that law were widely noted at the time, it would take many years before they were able to be addressed as part of the New Deal in the 1930s. There was a really muscular bill that was introduced in 1934 that would put strict new regulations on manufacturers, but opposition from industry and Republicans stagnated the bill until 1937, when the news that the S.E. Massengill product, elixir sulfanilamide, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, had resulted in the deaths of 107 people, was a new antibacterial drug, sulfa product. And because sulfanilamide didn't go into solution easily and young children had difficulty swallowing the pills, it was considered a great discovery when a chemist figured out that a solvent, the solvent of diethylene glycol, which is actually an antifreeze type product, which has a very sweet taste, would make it more palatable for kids, and the product was rushed to the market. Unfortunately, however, next slide please, it would also cause kidney damage, agonizing pain, and death. And although because of the way it was distributed, as Dan Carpenter has written about, a large number of the fatalities were actually in African American men, but really the poster child became a white child by the name of Joan Marler, whose mother's pleading letter to President Roosevelt was put in the congressional record. The full letter was placed there, as was a picture of her daughter. And so, although the power of the harmed or potentially harmed child in order to raise money had long been used with sophistication, but only occasional success by child welfare activists and public health reformers. But this really helped move that legislation that resulted in the 1938 Federal Food and Drug Act that gave the FDA new authority. But although the FDA law specified that drugs needed to be safe, which was new. Before that, they just needed to have in them what you said would be in them. But really, the 1938 was passed for a world in which it was expected that children, very few children, would be taking medications. Eminent Harvard pediatrician Charles Janeway actually later commented that when he trained at Harvard Boston Children's in the 1930s, there were only about 6 drugs that pediatricians needed to use. And so in the 1940s and 50s, as lots of new drugs poured onto the market, the FDA felt it had no statutory authority to regulate dosage standards in kids as part of the approval process, which made it impossible, I argue, to know whether the drug is safe, because too much is a poison, too little is ineffective. The 1940s and the late 30s, 40s and 50s would see skirmishes back and forth between the FDA, industry, the USP, the standard setting authority for medicinal chemistry, the United States Pharmacopoeia, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the AMA. But no one was ever on the page at the same time. Physicians, especially pediatricians, in the 1940s and 50s, also really physicians really sought to mute the really disciplinary skirmishes between nurses, physicians, and pharmacists. Nurses and pharmacists long had prescribed proprietary agents to their patients, and physicians won all of those skirmishes, and that resulted in 1951 Durham-Humphrey Act, which put drugs into either prescription or over-the-counter categories. But there was one group that pediatricians would have a much more difficult group of fighting against, and that was mothers. And next slide, please. As Chicago pediatrician Isaac Apt would note as much when he warned in 1944 that the mother of long ago, in general, was easier to work with than the mother of today. Although she was often garrulous, she was quick to observe deviations from normal and report them exactly, permitting the doctor to interpret the facts. And I could have put up 10 different pediatricians' autobiographies that say virtually the same thing. He said, the old-fashioned mother said, baby sniffles every night and has a rattle in his throat. The modern mother, on the contrary, is inclined to make her own diagnosis. Baby is allergic, she says. By the 1950s, peaked pediatricians and general practitioners are noting voluminously in the literature that parents are demanding brand new antihistamines for everything from colic for nausea and vomiting, as well as penicillin and other drugs that were newly classified as prescription. So it's in this era that Harry Shirky comes to prominence. Unable to afford medical school, he trained as a pharmacist and practiced as a pediatric pharmacist for a number of years in Cincinnati before he went to medical school. By 1961, he was the nation's leading voice on issues related to pediatric pharmaceutical policy. He consulted to the FDA. He led AAP, AMA, and USP committees. And people remember thalidomide rightly for having set the template that would lead to American drug regulation post-1962. But there was another drug disaster that actually happened just before it that's received far less attention, and that was chloramphenicol. Next slide, please. 1959, a number of hospitals reported a surprisingly high newborn death rate in infants who had received chloramphenicol, which had been out on the market for about 10 years, to prevent infection. After a few doses, infants developed respiratory distress and turned a dusky gray. The mortality rate was highest in premature infants, and it would later be revealed that most preemies lacked the necessary enzymes to metabolize chloramphenicol adequately. As the evidence mounted that chloramphenicol might cause what soon became known as gray baby syndrome, pediatricians began investigating the problem. Their efforts, however, revealed the challenges inherent in pediatric drug research. The study that demonstrated chloramphenicol's toxicity did so definitively because it killed many of the infants who received it. It's using what was then becoming the randomized clinical trial. It was a three-arm trial for babies whose mothers had premature rupture of the membranes, which put them at risk for infection. One arm got no drug, one arm got penicillin, one arm got chloramphenicol, and the penicillin kids did okay. The healthiest kids were the kids that got nothing, and there was like a 68% mortality rate in these babies. And I've been lucky enough at Johns Hopkins, the Allen Mason Chesney Archives, to get access to some of these records after following a cumbersome IRB approval process, and you can just see the tragedy of all these babies getting this drug. And so, of course, you know, this was an era in which the lack of informed consent, and there's nothing in the records about informed consent, was really the norm for the era. Consent was haphazard at best, or non-existent. There were large-scale isoniazid trials going on for pediatric tuberculosis in which consent was very spotty, and as well as we know, lots of vaccine trials going on in children and vulnerable people in vulnerable populations, such as institutionalized people. So, but it was the tranquilizer thalidomide that would spur the next legislation and bring chloramphenicol under FDA scrutiny. And before thalidomide, Tennessee Senator Estes Cafavers proposed Senate 1552. The legislation had been introduced earlier but hadn't progressed. And actually, it wasn't supposed to do anything with kids at all. It was to address drug costs. Had nothing to say about children. And thalidomide gained traction in a way that chloramphenicol didn't for a couple of reasons. First of all, thalidomide was gruesome in a way that a dying child was not. The pictures of the gruesome thalidomide disaster. I also think that American interest, the post-war interest in the children in terms of policy stimulus crystallized in the early 1960s. We had a president with young children, one of whom had died while he was president-elect. The middle class was expanding rapidly. American wealth and power were translating into a lot of rhetoric about children's health and welfare. There had just been the 50th anniversary of the first White House conference on children. There was a three-volume manifesto issued for the importance of investing in post-war children, and investigation, and in recognition of the need for more pediatric-related research and practitioners. In 1961, President Kennedy's sister, Eunice Shriver, had convinced him to propose the first NIH institute not focused on a disease or organ system, would become the National Institute for Child Health and Development. And so there were a lot of discussions underway about the paucity of scientists and health personnel needed to address children's issues in the early 1960s that just weren't happening in 1959, 1960. The thalidomide story has been well told, and so I'm really not going to tell it here, although I just have a slide of the drug being marketed in Europe. That's the physician Frances Kelsey that blocked the drug from coming to the market. She's been given the Distinguished Civilian Medal by President Kennedy. But reading the transcripts of the hearings and the papers of others involved, I've really uncovered what I think is an interesting story with Harry Shirky as actor, Helen Taussig, who was a pediatric cardiologist best known for the Blue Baby operations at Johns Hopkins, John Nestor, the only pediatrician at the FDA, who say that they're consciously going to use thalidomide to do what they've been writing and talking about for years, and that is to try and get better policy for children. Let's use this disaster. Let's frame our testimony. Let's bring in these pictures of these babies. Let's, Helen Taussig asks the senators as men, what would you do if this was your child? What would you do if this was your wife? And out of that comes the 1962 law, although it's another moment where the American Academy of Pediatrics and the AMA are at each other's throats. Morris Fishbein, who was the former editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, writes a letter to the New York Times where he threatens any physician who testifies in front of CAFARA's committee as a scientific leftist. He charges them. There's actually pretty light representation from the AMA with regard to at the hearings, and it's really when the American Academy of Pediatrics comes into its own as a voice for kids. So by the time President Kennedy signed what would be the bill, the FDA had received sweeping new responsibilities, lots of new responsibilities. I won't go into all of them here, but it brought them into all phases of the drug development process. So in terms of clinical testing, you couldn't do that before you submitted your application. You had to first submit an application and then go to the FDA. Drugs needed to not just be safe, but they needed to be efficacious. They needed to actually have a therapeutic benefit. And it was really the first mandate for informed consent written into federal law, and included language that drugs could only come to market after there had been adequate and well-controlled investigations. And at first, Harry Sherkey's thrilled. He thinks this is going to fix the problem. He, in an attempt to get all stakeholders on the same page, he gets himself on even more committees. He gets himself actually the head of the AMA's Council on Drugs, in addition to some of his other appointments. But within the year, he begins to see ominous signs that the 1962 law, he doesn't think, is going to protect children. He notes with great disappointment that the additional pediatric drug safety data that he sought is being circumvented by drug companies who put on their labels, "This drug is not indicated for children." Without a specific requirement that anyone systematically gather new data, or even collate and study the data that's available, children began to be left out of the improvements that were already beginning to make a difference for adults. There were really, to be sure, actually formidable barriers to moving ahead. And just to tell you a few of them that are in the literature from the 1960s is that nobody's clear on how to design a study with meaningful endpoints in a child, an evolving physiological target. They're trying to figure out under what circumstances adult data can be extrapolated. Do immature animal models, which ones translate to humans? Were they going to need drug studies for preemies, then newborns, toddlers, school-age children, all the different subcategories of within pediatrics? And then given the paucity of scientists, who's actually going to do all this? The NICHD had just created a developmental pharmacology program, but they said it was going to take, years, if not decades, for it to begin to pay off. And there's not even consensus about pediatric pharmacology's place within medicine's specialty substructure, which is a decision that had huge philosophical and reimbursement implications. For example, if pediatric pharmacologists were situated in medical school clinical departments, the revenue streams accrued there and not in the bench science units that were training them and actually designing a lot of the studies, the basic science studies, and analyzing the results. But finally and critically, who should incur the cost of drug development? And everyone has an answer. It's government, it's medical schools, it's hospitals, it's parents, it's insurers, it's industry, and everyone has a different answer. And all of these issues by the mid-1960s needed to be considered in the context of the tectonic shifts that we were seeing in healthcare economics. The old, largely self-pay or charity-supported care was being supplanted by a growing number of Americans covered under private employer-sponsored health plans and the new public Medicare and Medicaid. So the fact that the poor no longer could be coerced or needed to be coerced to participate in research in order to receive care, the mandate included in the 1962 law that stipulated informed consent, and then followed on the heels by Harvard anesthesiologist Henry Beecher's damning critique of biomedical research ethics, all combined to dramatically alter the social and political context that would underpin medical research. Three major conferences, many internal FDA meetings, and numerous attempts, some by industry actually, to figure out how to move forward, all end with the same, let's create another commission. And they all, it's when you read them all together, what's most striking to me is that they talk about the difficult issues. They talk about testing. They talk about the issue of proxy consent for a child. What no one talks about in any of these meetings is who's going to pay for this. It's just completely silent. Any progress on issues surrounding testing in kids stalled, pending consensus about ethics. There, in the 1970s, there's hearings on Capitol Hill about what would then be the Tuskegee, then Willowbrook. And so by the mid-1970s, Caspar Weinberger, who was actually then Secretary of Health and Human Services, could you go to the next slide, please? He says that basically he admits that until there's some consensus about informed consent, that really that the 1962 law isn't going to be able to be put into place for children. So this is now 13 years later, and we're really seeing significant gains for adults at this point. Weinberger, like everybody else, waited the findings of a National Academy of Science committee and panel to recommend human subjects research protections. Would be released in 1977, would build on work that had the FDA had commissioned from the American Academy of Pediatrics about informed consent guidelines, and also another study about study design. And so by 1979, with these new rules, there's real excitement that everything's in place to begin to make significant progress. And the FDA issues a ruling that says any pediatric indications that need to be included on the label, and that they're not going to approve any drug that doesn't have them, need a full description, and they have to be accompanied by dosing and administration information. And this is the 1979, this is the International Year of the Child, and everyone writes that this is just a propitious moment for this to take place. But, however, everyone avoided the issue of cost, and as a result, you don't know what happened is that first one company just bypassed the FDA and continued to put the label that wasn't indicated for use in children, and there was no consequence to that. There was no economic incentive for them to do any different, and then once one of them did it, they all did it, and things continued as usual. So, and by that point, 1979, although the issue of cost in drug development had never been incidental in the United States, as the pharmaceutical industry continued to comprise a larger sector of the American economy and healthcare costs would begin to escalate in the 1970s, the issue of cost would become more important and children continued to fall farther and farther behind. One thing that's really clear is the many ways in which the 1962 Act had altered drug development in the United States and the unintended consequences for children, because by 1979, you make money and return investment to your shareholders when you get to the market fast, first, and frequently. And children make all of those things extremely difficult to impossible. And there's that now also consequences of an unpleasant New York Times headline that you've some way injured children that nobody wants. They just consider there's nothing in it for them. The market remained small, research design complex, et cetera, et cetera. So the answer to who speaks for children was who pays for children, which, and the answer was nobody. And although I know that that's not a particularly surprising revolution, I think it's worth pointing out because this is an era between 1962 and the 1980s where you pick up, we talk about progress for American child, how things are getting better for children, for all children, that we have a social safety net for poor children, that this is really a very child-centered age. And so we're suffused with rhetoric, although it would be another generation before we would have the legislation, BPCA and PREA, which was enacted in 2002, although it's up for reauthorization in 2013, and it was not enacted permanently, so it has to come up every 5 years. And so I would argue that we still haven't made that commitment yet to children, and I'm really hopeful that in 2013 we will make those statutes permanent. I think that that's the only way that we're going to get industry to make the investments that they need to make. They know that this law is here; it's here to stay. And I think that that's sort of what the evidence shows from history. So thank you very much. All right.